Welcome to Rooster Radio. I'm Andrew Montesi with James Begley. We're talking to Joseph Mensel, the founder of Massive Joes, a brand that is a household name in the fitness industry, both in Australia and even internationally, but a business story that isn't widely known. Massive Joes is one of Australia's largest supplement retailers, with a booming web business, 8 stores across Adelaide and Perth, and another one opening soon in Sydney, and a separate apparel company that's growing globally. Joe explains how he builds brand loyalty. His company has a highly engaged social media community of 1 million users, and gyms are filled with people proudly wearing the Team Massive Joes brand. Joe benefits from being a first mover. He started importing supplements over a decade ago when few products were available locally, and he profited from launching the first supplement eBay store before building the first version of MassiveJoes.com. Amazingly, the company remained a side project for a number of years while Joe completed mechanical engineering and law degrees. After a stint in the Santos legal department, he decided to throw himself into Massive Joes full time. Joe takes us through the evolution of the company, the power and traps of social media, his vision for the business, and personally, how he lives the values of Massive Joes, both as a CEO and a bodybuilder. Enjoy our chat. Joe Mensel, welcome to our podcast.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Now,
good to be here.
We've done some research and you lead a pretty full-on life.
Mm-hmm.
What is an average day for you?
Oh, an average day. An average day when I'm in Adelaide?
Yeah, and you can't say, oh, I don't have an average day.
No, I do. I do. I do. I appreciate average days when they come along. So, an average day for me when I'm here in Adelaide looks like I'll get up first thing in the morning.
What time?
5:30 usually, sometime before 6. And I'll get stuck into emails straight away. We do a lot of business with companies in the US, which means when I get up, their day is finishing. So I have a lot of bits and pieces to get back to. So I'll go and address those emails first thing in the morning. Then I'll do some sort of exercise of some sort, cardiovascular based exercise. So I might walk outside or go to a CrossFit gym. A CrossFit workout.
For a person who spent their life in, training in the body, a walk counts as exercise, doesn't
it? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, most definitely. Something where when I say cardio-based workout, I'm talking about getting my heart rate up. So I'll do something to get my heart rate up. Second thing in the morning after I've, addressed those emails. Then I'll usually head to the office, get to the office by around 7:30, 8-ish, 8:30, depending on, how long I've spent doing the other things in the morning. I'll be at the office most of the day, unless I have the opportunity to do things like this, where I'll pop out and come and see you guys and do a podcast. I finish work most nights at work at the office around 7, and then I'll go to the gym and get my weight session in. So I lift weights 6 days a week. By the time I'm finished at the gym, it's 8:30, 9. I'll go home, have some dinner, do a little bit more work, and then usually get to bed by about midnight. That's a pretty wow. Standard routine type day.
Midnight?
Yep.
How many meals are you squeezing in out of interest?
Ah, well, that's a great question. I usually eat between 6 and 7 meals a day. Yeah. So eating every 2 or 3 hours pretty much on average.
Mm. What struck me about the training industry, I mean, this regimented lifestyle seems to be kind of non-negotiable.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
Not necessarily that it's non-negotiable. I think certain people work better with routine and certain people work better with chaos. I'm definitely the sort of person who works better with routine. And don't get me wrong, I do, quite often find myself in chaos when I'm traveling and, different cities and hotels and that sort of thing, which is why I said I'll give you a routine day in Adelaide. But I do really appreciate routine. It works well for me and I'm able to function very well with a set routine.
So on that, how do you manage this routine when you do travel interstate overseas? Mm-hmm. I mean, I follow you guys online and I've seen you post up of you in the gym at like 3 a.m.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it non-negotiable for you that you have to get these sessions in?
It depends what sort of phase of training I'm in. But I'll, for me personally, in terms of just balance as well, it would be very easy for me just to work, 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 work and have no balance. very easy. So, you know, in that regard, I like to get to the gym, you know, and do some sort of physical work within a 24-hour period.
So it's a mental refresher as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, most definitely. It's physically, it's difficult and stressful, but for me, psychologically, it's definitely kind of my downtime and my balance for sure.
And you have this, well, I would say unenviable predicament in that your business, your job is your body and mm-hmm. you can't be Fat Joe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to live what you preach.
Yeah. Practice what you preach.
Yeah,
absolutely.
But I am interested in how you review your business goals each day and, mm-hmm. and how do you link back what you're doing every day
mm-hmm.
to your sort of more medium-term objectives? Do you have a strong link between the two?
Absolutely, yeah. So I'm a big believer in very strategic planning, SMART goals. I'm sure you guys have heard the acronym SMART goals, which means, you know, you set goals that are specific, measurable, attainable, realistic and time-bound, and you can really drill down those goals from, you know, something that you may set as a 5-year goal or a 1-year goal or however long, down to what you need to do on a day-to-day, hour-by-hour basis on a very small micro level to reach those bigger macro long-term goals.
And that doesn't surprise me at all, because what I'm picturing really is you've just given yourself like a weights plan but for your business. You know, if you're good at periodizing your training,
mm-hmm.
is there much of a difference in terms of breaking things down? And
there's definitely a crossover in the logic based thought process, most definitely. Yeah, yeah. It's funny you ask that actually, because I studied before running Massive Joe's. I did a lot of study at university, so I was at Adelaide Uni and I was there for 7 years, and I studied mechanical engineering and law. And as a mechanical engineer, we always had this discussion at university with the guys that were doing engineering, because it seemed like a lot of guys in the gym who were interested in weights training and bodybuilding in particular were engineers. And we were like, how come there's so many guys studying engineering who are interested in, mm-hmm. you know, improving their bodies through periodization and weight programming and all of that? And I think that really touches on that as well, as it's that logical thought process that, you know, a lot of people have, but is very particular with engineers, that crosses over with bodybuilding and therefore crosses over from what I do with bodybuilding into Massive Joe's now as well. Yeah.
So Massive Joe's now, can you give us a little bit of context about what the business does for someone who hasn't heard of it and kind of the size of the business, where it's at?
Yeah, absolutely. So for anyone who's unaware, we are effectively a sports supplement and workout apparel retailer. We do also do distribution and wholesale, but you know, most people will know us as a retailer. In terms of, I guess, a snapshot of the business today in 2017. So we run the largest sports supplement website in Australia in terms of the amount of traffic that we generate to our website. Sales is a little bit difficult to ascertain. I like to think we're the biggest, but, you know, without knowing exactly what our competitors are doing, it's hard to make that claim. We run the largest social media network in the fitness industry in Australia, which incorporates YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, you know, all different types of social media. Periscope was there for a while as well.
What's the total following?
It's up around 1 million now. If you add up, you know, the YouTube subscribers, the Instagram followers, the Facebook likes, I guess you could throw Snapchat in there as well at some point.
Yeah, Periscope, Snapchat.
It's Periscope viewers. Who knows what the next big social media thing is going to be. But in addition to what we do online, we run 9 retail stores now. So we've got 7 here in Adelaide. We've got 1 in Perth, 1 in Melbourne, and we're about to open 1 in Sydney as well. So that'll be the Sydney one will be our 10th. So 10 retail stores across 4 states. We've got 30 employees now.
Wow.
So the payroll is through the roof, but it's good. I mean, you know, we've got a, you know, really good workforce. And with the apparel side of things, we run an international apparel brand. So send apparel all over the world.
There's a lot there that we're going to unpack. But as always, we love to know, at what point was the motivation for the business apparent? How did this start? Where did it start?
Well, I've already spoken about my university days, which is a good segue because that's really where it started for me. So I took an interest while I was studying down at Adelaide University in weights, and took a particular interest in the competitive bodybuilding, natural bodybuilding. And the reason for that was I used to play a lot of basketball when I was younger, injured myself in my late teens, so couldn't play basketball anymore. Had this competitive streak that, you know, I wanted to obviously fulfill, was interested in weights. And so, you know, looked into the competitive side of weights, which is either powerlifting or bodybuilding, and, you know, took an interest in bodybuilding. So I was at university, 18 years old, training, bodybuilding, competing, doing really well, and started to look at how I could increase my performance and you know, increase my ability to win competitions naturally, which was taking supplements. And at the time, what we could get in Australia was really lackluster, boring.
What year were we talking here?
We're talking, this is 2004, 2005. So yeah, supplements. I mean, you could
get a few supplements in like a health food store type
absolutely.
Of thing. Absolutely.
Yeah. You could pretty much, the only thing you could get was protein powder. And the ones that we had in Australia were not good. It was like drinking wet cardboard. things have definitely improved since then. So I took an interest in supplementation, and so I started looking in different countries for supplements and, you know, what was happening and, you know, which countries are doing what. And at the time, there was, a little bit earlier than that, there was a law passed in the United States where they changed the way that the supplement industry was regulated. So before this time, you had to prove that the supplement, it was effectively regulated like drugs are regulated. So you had to prove that your drug was able to work and was safe and pass all the regulatory structure, and the FDA would then approve it, and then you could take it to market.
Expensive.
Yeah, absolutely expensive, time-consuming, and just didn't work for the supplement industry. And the laws changed. So it effectively flipped it on its head. So as a supplement, as opposed to a pharmaceutical company, you could now produce a product, take it to market, and it was up to the FDA in the United States to prove that it was either unsafe or didn't work, and then they'd have to, you know, pull it off the market and whatnot.
Just quickly, so this had happened as you began looking into it, or you'd got into this and you were looking for supplements and then this regulation
No,
changed?
This happened beforehand.
Okay.
Yeah, so I had to give a bit of background.
So at this point, were you thinking,
saw an opportunity.
Yeah, or were you purely more still just looking at it from your own point
of view? No, I was just looking at it from my own perspective. But so when all of this happened, effectively the result of this was a lot of companies in the US started popping up making very effective supplements that they weren't otherwise able to make until this point. So I started looking at these products and started importing supplements from the United States for me to use personally, and started getting really good results, winning competitions. And the guys at the university gym, you know, I'm talking about like pre-workouts didn't exist. So I'd come into the gym drinking a shaker with like a blue or red or whatever color it is as I'm walking into the gym. And people would take notice of that. Now, you know, everyone does it.
Cliche.
But back then, yeah, I was the only guy doing that. During my workout, I'd have BCAAs, once again, a shaker or a water bottle with some colored stuff. People go, man, what is this guy doing? Post-workout, my protein shake, you know, I'd have that. So people started asking questions. And back then I was, you know, the bodybuilder doing well in competition. So I guess people kind of looked up to what I was doing and wanted to achieve similar things. So they started asking me about the products. And so I told them, and then they're like, well, you know, next time you order some for yourself, can you order some for me? Okay, no worries. So before I knew it, I was supplying most of the guys who worked out at the gym at Adelaide Uni with supplements.
And why did they not choose to just go and do it? Why were you, I mean, I can't remember where the internet was at and online ordering and all that, but what was it about you doing that that they just couldn't be bothered doing?
Back then, I think it was difficult.
Yeah,
much more difficult than it is now to order stuff from a different country in particular. You know, back then we didn't even have PayPal.
You forget, don't you?
How do you pay for, you know, something in a different country if you don't have something like PayPal to pay with it?
And when did you see the business opportunity, and what was the market like at the at that time?
Yeah, so effectively, to fast forward a little bit from there, so I was supplying Adelaide Uni gym girls with sups, and then, you know, they have friends at Flinders Uni and UniSA and these different university gyms. And before I knew it, I was supplying all of the university gyms with supplements, just selling person to person, didn't have a website or anything like that. And then I kind of, I guess I saw the opportunity because I was like, well, you know, if there's this much of a market in Adelaide at just universities, I hadn't even looked at other gyms, there must be, you know, people everywhere that want these sort of products.
And just to again contextualize it, you had a bit of a mind for business, didn't you? Because, I mean, I read that you were already selling other stuff and you dabbled with things as a teenager.
I always had, I guess, you know, people have said before an entrepreneurial streak. I'm not sure if that's really the best way to describe it, but, you know, I was the kid at high school. I'd go to the supermarket and buy a 30-pack, you know, of Coca-Cola cans and then undercut the canteen and sell them for, you know, $1.50 a can instead of $2 and get in trouble with the teachers at school because, you know, you can't do that.
But, such a common trait, isn't it? So many people we've spoken to are just the same.
Yeah. So, you know, I did that sort of thing. And through high school, you know, I pursued a few selling things online. So, you know, in high school, you guys remember those Lance Armstrong yellow wristbands?
Yeah, the Livestrong bands.
Yeah. So I saw an opportunity when I was in high school because heaps of people wanted those wristbands and no one could get them because they were only in the US. So I imported them, sold them online on eBay and sold them all over Australia.
So the die was cast a little bit in terms of this ability to bring stuff in and resell.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I had, you know, I guess I kind of knew how to do that from a business perspective to, you know, bring stuff in bulk and sell it at a retail level, I guess.
It's interesting there was no fear there because I know that from James's perspective, James still fears buying things off eBay because he thinks he's going to get ripped off by someone.
Hey, it does happen. It does happen. It's just very rare.
I trust lots of different things, but I have to admit I have never purchased anything on eBay.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Oh, there you go. You have to be one of the few,
so,
I'd say.
You can tell, we only have two listeners, so you can tell us, were you making a little margin on the protein at this point or the supplements?
Yeah, I was making a little bit. Yeah.
So at that point, it's already just this lean business that's probably producing some cash.
Yeah.
But was there a decision or a point where you had to go, I've actually got to outlay some money before I get it back? Or were you already doing pre-orders? So people were just saying, can you get me this?
So when I was supplying the guys at the gyms, it was all pre-order stuff. Yep. So they'd say, you know, next time you buy this pre-workout and this BCAA and this protein, can you throw on a couple of units for me? So that's how it was done. So then when I got to the point where I was supplying all the guys from the different university gyms in Adelaide, that's where I said, okay, I think there's an opportunity here. I already was experienced in selling stuff on eBay, the wristbands, and I sold iPods and just, you know, other things, other bits and pieces. And so that's really when I said, okay, well, let me invest some money here, you know, do like a, you know, rather than a box full of supplements, let's do like a pallet, bring them over. And then let's set up an eBay store. At the time, eBay stores were a new thing. Couldn't sell anything fixed price. It was all auction, but, you know, they were still starting to do these stores. And so I started selling supplements on eBay. I was the first person to do it in Australia.
How much was the outlay? Can you remember for that first pallet?
I reckon back then it would have been maybe a couple of grand.
Yep. As a 20-something...
19.
Still 19.
Yeah,
at this point.
Wow. This was 2005.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, end of 2005. So 19. I mean, it wasn't a lot of money.
No,
but
it's still a bit.
To
though,
a 19
year
old, it's, you know, it's a fair bit of cash.
Yeah, and there's a little bit of risk there as well.
Of course. Think, yeah, yeah.
I could lose this.
Yeah. Well, yeah, yeah. What if it gets seized by customs? What if it, you know, it doesn't meet regulation? What if I can't sell it?
Did that mean you have to go to a shipping container in Port Adelaide and offload it?
Not at that point. No, at that point, it was all air freight stuff. Okay. So yeah, it's different now. But so I guess that's really when I saw the opportunity as a business, so to speak, to do something. So I did that. I set up the eBay store, started importing products, and it was ridiculous to compare it to the market now. So I would, you know, to put in perspective for you guys, I'd pay. In Australian dollars back then, say like $30 for a pre-workout landed, and I'd put it on eBay. And I was the only person doing this. No one else was selling supplements. It wasn't fixed price. It was auction only. So I put it on eBay, set the reserve price so I'd break even, and then people would auction these products up. And back then, I remember I'd buy stuff for like $30 and it'd sell for like $120. And I'm like, what the hell is going on here?
Oh, man.
Because I was selling it to guys at the uni gym for like 40 or 50, you know, so I'm making 20% GP and now I'm putting it on eBay and it's going to, you know, Queensland, Victoria, WA, wherever. And I'm, you know, I'm literally, you know, turning my money over three or four times on every product that I'm bringing in. So that's when I knew there's definitely a market for this. You know, this is a good opportunity to do something here.
And just on that, what is it about nutritional supplements and just, you know, the nutrition world in general?
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit like, you know, mums and babies or parents and babies. It's a bit like me and my bike.
Yeah,
I'll pay anything. Yep. If I believe I'm getting like the best, and if it's cheaper, to be honest, it's probably going to be worse. That's mm-hmm. my mentality.
Mm-hmm.
Does that ring true in the nutritional world, or did it ring true back then? If I'm paying a lot, this must be good gear.
I don't think that's ever rung completely true in the nutrition side of things, and I think primarily because of our, you know, the primary market that we appeal to is say 16 to 30 year olds, maybe 16 to 40 year olds now. So you do have a lot of people who are very budget conscious in there. So they'll, you know, try and find the exact product that they're looking for at the best possible price. Right. So it's kind of a little bit different in that respect.
But your eBay store, so you're talking about these massive margins, you're going, geez, there's something in this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, are you talking a few sales a week at the time, or is it starting to crank up well beyond that?
Yeah, so we were talking back then, I'd do probably like a pallet a month, I reckon. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't big volumes, but as a 19-year-old, I'm making $100 a tub of pre-workout. I'm like, this is fantastic.
Mm.
So I guess the next step from there, very quickly, as any online marketplaces, you know, competition came. So my profit started getting, you know, eroded. Well, not necessarily eroded down, but people had more choices on what they were bidding on as an auction-based website. So, you know, I was selling it for 110, 100, 90, 80, and then eBay decides to introduce fixed price listings, which just killed everything because now people were selling, you know, you had guys that were just undercutting and competing on price and whatnot. So the $30 tub of pre-workout that I was selling for 120, you know, now guys were selling fixed price for like 45. So
and how quickly did that world change from 120 bucks
to very, very quickly. I think like less than 12 months. Yeah. Yeah. Really, really quick. That's the nature of competition, obviously. So
at this point, what are you thinking with the status of the business? Are you thinking, you know what, I'm going to really have a crack at this, or you might just keep it?
Okay. So at this point, remember that I'm studying, and I'm studying two pretty intense degrees. I'm studying mechanical engineering and I'm studying law. And so that the eBay side of things goes on for, you know, like a year, then all of these changes come in. So my primary focus is still study. You know, I wanted to be working in a law, the law side of an oil and gas company was kind of where, you know, that's why I was studying those sorts of things. I wanted to work in procurement or mergers and acquisitions or something for, you know, one of the big oil and gas companies. That was always my goal. But this was kind of nice to have on the side. It gave me a bit of pocket money. I didn't have to go and work, you know, bartending or tutoring or doing anything. This was effectively paying my way through university. So I kept kind of pursuing it, you know, in my spare time. So one of the things when eBay introduced the fixed price policy that I straight away noticed was I needed to get off eBay because it was just, you know, the whole online marketplace side of things is about encouraging competition, getting the best deal for the consumer, which is fantastic for the consumer, but profits get eroded because you're all selling the same stuff and everyone competes on price. And that's how eBay is designed to operate. So I knew I needed to get off and do my own thing with my own website. So I got with a good friend of mine who I went to school with, who was at university at the same time. And I said, can you build me a website? And he said, yeah, absolutely. This is how much it's going to cost. I said, well, let's do it. And so I started the first version of MassiveJoes.com.
We always talk about launching websites and it always brings a few beads of sweat.
Mm-hmm.
What was the first version like? Did you pull your hair out?
Disgusting.
Did it break?
Yeah, all of the above. All of the above. I've still got the raw files of it. And I mean, if you loaded it now, you know, it's horrible. It, you know, back then it was
decent.
Can
you remember a feature that just stood out as being kind of, now you look,
it didn't
about
have any features. This was the whole thing. It was like, back then it was like, draw yourself a sitemap. You've got a home page, you've got product pages, and you've got a cart, and that's it. You know, and it was very simple. There was no Flash. There was no HTML coding that was anything. There was no JavaScript.
And what about
nothing.
Your branding? What was your branding? Was it still the logo that you've got today?
No. Yeah,
can you remember what it was?
Yeah, it was. It's actually, I've got this printout in front of me. It's not too far from that. It was a blue muscle man, which was based off an Arnold Schwarzenegger pose inside a star. And around the star, so blue, red star, and then around the star, it had Massive Joe's. It was called Massive Joe's Nutrition back then. It had Massive.
So a
Joe's
fair
Nutrition.
Bit happening.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Disgusting.
But it was Massive Joe's from day dot.
It was. Yeah.
And the backstory to the name, obviously, after your good self.
Guys at the uni used to call me Massive Joe, so I was like, "We'll run with it." Sounds good.
Better than Sloppy Joe's.
Yeah. Exactly.
And at this point, you know, your technical knowledge pretty rudimentary, or did you have some understanding from, you know, coding and you know, like
I had
how it
a
works?
Very very basic understanding. Yep. Yeah, so I knew you know, what code did. I didn't necessarily know how to write code. Yep. I knew how to read code pretty well, so I could see what code was doing. But if you told me to go and write code for a website, no chance. That's why I got my good friend to help me.
But enough to give direction. And,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Enough to know what was possible and what wasn't possible, that sort of thing. And to give direction to, you know, to get a website up and running.
So you're starting to, you know, build some sales. What was the catalyst to give you real growth?
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
Okay, so to get to that point, we need to fast forward to when I finished studying. Pretty much, because
see, degrees just always get in the way, don't they? That was
but truthfully, I mean, you know, studying those kind of intense degrees was the majority of my time. So that's what I spent doing most of the time, and then I had this business on the side. Like I said, it was just kind of paying my way through uni, and so that went on for, you know, 5-6 years until I finished university. And through there as well, the way my degree was structured was I finished mechanical engineering after 4 years and then finished the rest of the law degree the 3 years after that. So when I finished mechanical engineering, I actually went and worked as well because I was a qualified engineer. So I went, in my second to last year of engineering, I got an internship at Santos here in Adelaide. And then after that internship, they offered me a job. They knew I was studying at the time, so it was, I guess you could call it a part-time job. I was there 4 days a week. So at university, finishing off my law degree, working at Santos 4 days a week, training, and then running Massive Joe's in the few hours a week that I had spare. And that was my life for 3 years, pretty much, until I finished studying. And then so when I finished my law degree, funnily enough, I was given the opportunity by Santos because they kind of knew what my intention was the whole time, was to get into the legal side of oil and gas. I was given the opportunity by them to go and work in the legal department in Santos I was there a little over 6 months, and was not what I expected it would be at all. You know, it was literally like being hit with a brick wall.
What do you mean?
I thought it would be, you know, interesting, and I get to use.
It'll be like Suits, the show.
I haven't seen Suits, but yeah, let's
go with
that.
You know where I'm going.
I've heard about Suits, but I thought it'd be, you know, making deals and talking, you know, being able to talk about engineering things, but with a legal background, and it wasn't. It was effectively proofreading contracts. That absolutely, it was administration. The guys that were doing the deals were the board of directors, you know, the CEO and the managing director and, you know, the heads of the different departments, and they just kick all the shit down to the legal team to proofread and make sure that, you know, it was all good, and they'd sign off on it and away you go. And I was like, and that wasn't just what I was doing. That's what, like, the head of the legal department was doing. And I was like, man, this is not what I signed up for. This is not what I expected it would be at all. Which was, you know, very disappointing to me at the time. But, you know, looking back on it, it's really something that kind of pushed me to do what I do now. So when I saw that, And I was trying to figure out, what, you know, what am I going to do here? Am I going to stick with this job with Santos? Do I go back to engineering? Do I go and work in a private law firm? I really don't know. I'd effectively kind of, you know, my hopes and dreams of what I was going to do professionally had been crushed. And at the time I was like, well, you know, I've got this business and it's doing, you know, at the time it was, I could have, you know, lived off it, just what I was doing part-time, as, you know, and provided me with an income.
So some scope, what would you have been doing in a 12-month period revenue?
Back then, probably $500,000 a year, I reckon. Just off the top of my head, I could actually look that up for you. I'm sure I've got it somewhere.
That's substantial.
Yeah, yeah. For a part-time gig, yeah.
But you didn't. Did you know what you were sitting on, really, or you didn't really understand what you were sitting on?
No, of course not. No, definitely not. But because of what happened professionally, I was, you know, I was like, well, you know, I've got this business. If I throw myself full-time at it for a couple of years and it doesn't work, what's the worst that can happen? I go back and I work as an engineer, or I go work for a private law firm or whatever. It really doesn't matter. So from my perspective, it was pretty much a no-lose situation. So I decided to commit to Massive Joe's full-time and kind of put everything that I had into the business and see, you know, where we could take it.
Just on that, where did you first see the fruits of throwing everything in? Like, was it something?
What areas you mean?
Yeah, well, like, when did you first start seeing results from actually dedicating to it?
I would say so. This is 2011 now. I would say it probably took 2 years.
Okay.
Before I started to really kind of see traction in the amount of effort that I was putting in, because it's, you know, it's kind of like Pareto principle. You know, 30% effort gets you 70% of your results. And then what does the extra 70% get you? And how long does it take to generate that last, you know, that last bit of 30? It doesn't exactly work like that, but that's kind of what I'm getting at. And it probably took 2 years. I'd say, you know, probably 2013, we really started, you know, really started kicking off.
And in what areas? Like, how did you know? Was it your social following? Was it simply sales? Like, what was moving?
A combination of both, I'd say. So obviously, you know, we had a big paradigm shift in social media. So Facebook was around back then, but it was still very early days. Yep.
MySpace had died.
MySpace was dead.
Facebook was just starting to get some traction.
Facebook was getting traction.
Twitter.
Not so much in the health and fitness industry. Twitter doesn't really play a big part, but Facebook, then Instagram, Snapchat. You had YouTube was starting to become huge in the United States. Still not that big over here just yet, but it will eventually. So you had, you know, a bunch of different things happening, and I think they kind of all played into you know, that return on effort investment, so to speak. So,
well, on that, tell us a little bit more about the role that social media played, because for some people get this impression that social media just happens. Yeah, you know, you get a page and it just goes.
Yep.
But this is a massive part of what you do. So maybe take us back to the start.
Huge.
And how you, when you first started dabbling with social
media. Yeah, sure. So the reason why I started dabbling with social media was pretty much out of necessity, because I didn't have a marketing budget. I didn't have money to spend on marketing. So I remember I was up at the back when I was still studying engineering. So this would have been mid-2000s, I reckon. And I was up in the engineering suite and doing some work, working on a project, and one of the guys in my group had this website up, and I was like, what's that? And he's like, I just wrote on my friend's wall. I'm like, what are you talking
that's
about?
That's graffiti. That's illegal.
Yeah, I was like, legit, that's what I was thinking. I'm like, what are you talking about writing on your friend's wall? And he's like, oh, there's this new website. It's called Facebook. And, you know, you can, you know, get friends and write on their walls and, you know, talk to people and network. And I was like, oh, okay. And just kind of brushed it off. I was like, yeah, you know, just another shitty website. And then obviously Facebook just like exploded. And everybody had Facebook. And I saw the opportunity right away from Massive Joe's, because I didn't have a marketing budget. I didn't have any way to connect to people to use Facebook effectively as a marketing tool. Because back then I was supplying Adelaide University gym, but I knew the guys at Adelaide Uni had friends who were going to Uni SA, who had friends who were going to Flinders Uni, and everybody could be connected through Facebook and, you know, start talking to each other. So pretty much out of necessity, I started using Facebook to market my business to people who I otherwise couldn't reach through other types of advertising, because I didn't have any budget to do it.
I'm just going to jump in and sure. we'll come back, just pause there.
Yeah.
This seems to be a pattern though in that you are very quick to take up something new.
Yeah.
Like absolutely. You did it with, you know, online, you did it with eBay.
Yeah.
You're doing it like, so this must be a pattern whether you're conscious
first
or not.
First mover.
Yeah, first just try it, get it. Get yeah. in there and do something.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if, you know, if I see a good opportunity, and I mean the risk of not necessarily failure, but if it fails, the risk of things flowing on from that is not great, then I'll try it straight away. Jump in and you know, and give it a go and kind of see what happens. Sorry. See what sinks or swims.
Yeah. So yeah, continue.
Yeah. So that's pretty much kind of how Facebook came about. And that became, you know, back when it was just Facebook, became a very big part of our marketing strategy. And then through the evolution, I mean, we still use Facebook today, through the evolution of Facebook where they, you know, started opening pages and then you could have business pages and then you could start advertising and, you know, that whole kind of shift with advertising, I guess, from your mainstream media to your digital media. We were, you know, really a part of that through necessity.
And one of the great advantages is this, all these social channels, so much of the content on there is about health, what you look like, well-being, you know, what your skin looks like, what your hair looks like, what your muscles look like.
Well, it's all visual and pictorial.
I mean, so heaven forbid you're a book or something and then the internet comes into play. It's not the best, but it obviously suited this.
Well, absolutely. Space. Yeah, it definitely did. And I mean, you kind of fast forward to now and you know, we use social media a lot. It's definitely our biggest form of we spend now on it, but it's our biggest form of advertising spend and definitely our biggest form of generating exposure for the business.
Can I just ask how you use the different mediums in your own mind?
Yeah.
So just give us a rundown, Snapchat, Facebook.
Yeah, Instagram. Absolutely. So I guess if we start up Facebook now is paid advertising. So if you don't pay for things on Facebook, nobody's going to see it. It definitely wasn't like that when it first started. I mean, you know, I could compare, I think I've still got statistics because we keep track of them for years. But, you know, when we used to do Facebook posts and you can see the amount of reach. And then when they had their first big algorithm shift, which is when they introduced Facebook advertising, is that reach went from, I think it was, you know, 60 or 70%. And then it was forced down to less than 2 because they wanted people to start paying. And then it got forced down to less than 1. And now it's like points of a percentage, unless you pay for it. If you pay Facebook, they'll show it to whoever you want them to show it to. So now Facebook, a big part of Facebook is paid. And that's really the only way you can reach people through Facebook, unless you happen to do something that goes viral, but it's very rare.
And do you have a look and a feel for Facebook? Like, do you have a strategy for Facebook?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And that's, how does that differ from some of the other channels?
Okay, so then if you look at the other channels, so then if we look at Instagram, for example, Instagram obviously now is owned by Facebook, so very similar once again. You get a little bit more reach through Instagram than you do Facebook, but it's still paid. If you want, you know, I mean, on Instagram now we've got 341,000 followers. The only way we can reach them now is if we pay to promote posts. Otherwise, Instagram will show less than 1%. I mean, it's a business, and it's owned by Facebook. So, of course, they're going to do that. So Instagram is also, you know, very much paid. You can get some more viral type activity on Instagram if you get people tagging and commenting and their friends see it and that sort of thing, but it's primarily paid. Snapchat is non-paid at all, which is fantastic. And Snapchat, you get fantastic reach to people who follow you. Still until they figure out how to monetize it.
I was going
to
say with the filing of the IPO, I wonder how much longer you've got of free
Snapchat. Yeah. YouTube is another big one for us. So YouTube is completely unpaid. We spend nothing on YouTube at all. The fantastic thing about YouTube is YouTube is owned by Google. So if you do things on YouTube that rank very highly, they rank very highly on Google. It therefore increases your reputation with Google and you can generate more website traffic. The problem with YouTube is it's much more time intensive and therefore much more financially intensive to produce YouTube videos, good ones that people actually want to watch.
What sorts of stuff do you have on YouTube usually?
All sorts of stuff. Yeah. So we do, I mean, from a health and fitness perspective, we do training videos, we do healthy recipe videos, we do supplement review videos. We do vlogs. So we do, you know, just entertainment-based videos. We do a lot of stuff on YouTube. I mean, our YouTube plan, I think we've got 10 different video series that are currently running.
Andrew Montesi loves the gym and actually asked me before.
I'd actually love to ask a question during this interview. It'd be nice.
Andrew asked me before you came to maybe ask you on air if you would do a vlog with him on his training regime.
Yeah.
Because he's quite proud of it.
Yeah.
And he thinks your listeners and your viewers
would appreciate it. What are you even talking about, mate?
It might be different to the usual bodybuilding style.
You know what? This interview was really good until that moment. But can we just come back to your, I guess your more overarching brand strategy?
Sure.
Like at the moment, social media,
yep.
in the health space,
mm-hmm.
everyone's trying to be a bloody fitness influencer. Everyone's trying to be the next big thing in this health space.
It's changed a lot, you know, and I kind of, as much as I love social media and what it's been able to do for Massive Joes and, you know, the competitive advantage that it's given us, because it's a huge competitive advantage over, I spoke to you guys off air about who our big competitors are, you know, interstate. None of them do anywhere near what we do on social media. So from a competitive advantage point of view, it's fantastic. I do, you know, on a more ethical level, worry about social media because I think, you know, now it really is a breeding ground for insecurities for both guys and girls in and outside of the health and fitness industry.
And you're very aware of that, I guess, when you produce content?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. So we'll never produce content that's, you know, sexist or, you know, look at me because my body looks fantastic sort of thing. There's always something educational or something motivational or, you know, something that's actually going to help people rather than look at this person, you don't look as good as this person, therefore you're shit.
And you touched on the male insecurities, that become even more prevalent, has it, over the last?
Oh, most definitely, yeah.
How does that play out? Absolutely. How do you see that?
I mean, we see that in our customers, you know, for sure. I don't do a lot of retail floor sales anymore, but when I do, you know, you can see it straight away. So, yeah, huge. I think social media really has just become a breeding ground for that sort of thing. But, yeah, it's unfortunate, but...
One thing I've noticed in seeing the way you guys approach social, and I don't really want to use this word because it's a bit cliche, but it's authentic.
Yep.
Like it's like you will personally get on there and write a massive rant on your Instagram about issues. Do you find that that's something that perhaps separates you guys from just being a stock standard store?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It works a couple of ways. I think firstly what it does is it puts a face to the business. So people know, you know, I'm the owner of the business and they can personally connect with me rather than connecting with a brand that you can't build a personal connection with. You can build an emotional connection but not a personal connection. And I think the other thing it does is definitely reinforces that authenticity is, you know, a lot of those things that I put up on my personal social media accounts are about, you know, I see this issue, here's something to help you get through it. Or here's something to say, you know what, it's really not that big a deal. There's bigger things in life to worry about, that sort of stuff. So, yeah, I kind of use that, I guess, as my little, way to try and make things better.
Hmm.
So,
have you been conscious of you and the brand and the link and the benefits right from the beginning, or is it something you've stumbled across and just kept
promoting? No, I've always been a big fan of brands who have kind of keynote people heading them. So I was a huge fan of Steve Jobs and Apple. You know, I still do idolize Steve Jobs. Another one's Richard Branson and the Virgin Group. You know, I've always kind of looked up to these guys. Jordan Brand, I love my Jordans. You've got obviously it's owned by Nike, but you've got Michael Jordan as kind of the person behind that brand. So I've always looked up to brands that have those kind of, you know, owner or figurehead at the front that you can connect personally with. So yeah, I've always been very conscious of that.
And I guess this community that you've fostered, it's humanized. People are just super passionate about it. Mm-hmm. And one thing that just constantly amazes me is the fact that I'll go to the gym and every second person in the gym seems to be wearing your brand now.
It's good. It's what we like to see.
How did how have you seen that evolve from supplements into apparel into people just being so passionate about your brand, they will actually pay you to wear your name?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's very surreal. You know, I guess I've kind of become used to it, so to speak, without kind of sounding egotistical, in Australia. But when we go overseas and we see it in, you know, gyms in Europe and the USA and people wearing Team Massive Joes, I'm like, wow, that's some pretty cool, you know, some cool stuff. I mean, the apparel, when we started with apparel, it was just, you know, promotional type gym stuff. Once again, it was sort of that thing where, out of necessity, because I didn't have a big marketing budget, I'm like, how am I going to get exposure for my brand to people who are in my target market? And obviously, you need to get into gyms. And I thought, well, everyone wears apparel when they're training. Why don't I make some promotional singlets with Massive Joes on it and give them away to people who are good customers of mine? And I literally did. I gave them away. I wasn't selling anything. It was like, man, you know, I really appreciate your business. Have a Massive Joes singlet. And, you know, it was free, so, and they were good quality, so people loved them. So they'd, you know, start wrapping them and you know, then they started popping up all over the place. And kind of, I guess, as that progressed, I saw the opportunity because there wasn't really, you know, unless you wanted to wear Nike or Adidas or one of the big kind of sports apparel brands, there wasn't really a gym specific brand back then. I mean, Lorna Jane was around for girls, but for guys, there was nothing. So I, you know, saw the opportunity to do some workout specific apparel, and you know, brand it slightly differently to Massive Joe so that it wasn't a promotional type, you know, piece of apparel that was promoting Massive Joe's. It was really its own brand, and people would purchase the product rather than be given it as free apparel because they like the product and because they like the brand rather than because they're, you know, representing and walking billboard sort of thing. Obviously they still are, but it's not as forced, I guess, because Massive Joe's isn't all over it. The apparel has just kind of been something we've really done on the side until we started focusing on apparel probably 18 months ago was when it was really like, okay, we need to start paying some proper attention to this.
What percentage of your turnover now kind of would be apparel focused?
In 2016, it was less than 5%.
Yep.
So it's still, you know, a small, in terms of overall revenue, it's a very small part of the business, but you see it everywhere. So
it's got other benefits.
Can you measure that link between the apparel perhaps serving the purpose of driving sales of your products? I mean, is that something that can be measured, or is it just something that you can kind of...
I don't know how you'd measure it.
I know. That's what I'm saying. It's almost...
I'd love to be able to. I like measuring everything, but I'm not really too sure.
But it's got to be... It's got to have a massive impact, doesn't it?
Yeah, well...
In some way.
I guess one of the cool things that we've been able to do with apparel is the way we tie it into the supplement side of the business, because now the apparel, it's not branded as Massive Joe's, it's branded as TMJ. So it's its own business. It's its own business, its own brand. It literally has nothing to do with Massive Joe's other than, you know, I own both the businesses. But the way that I guess we've been able to tie the two together is we've got a loyalty program for the supplement side of the business, where, you know, you sign up for our loyalty program. Every dollar you spend on supplements, you earn points, and you can cash those points in for TMJ apparel. So I guess that's kind of how we've tied those two together. But so far as being able to measure, you know, the effect that apparel sales has on supplement sales, your guess is as good as mine.
Yet again, jumping in, you know, there wouldn't be too many supplement businesses that have loyalty programs that are linked to apparel. Obviously innovating the space, linking that into a segue with Steve Jobs, you're an online business. Bricks and mortar retail is shrinking. Everyone's going online. Apple decides to open stores. How did the store journey begin?
Yeah. It was something that I was dead against. Like, was not interested in bricks and mortar stores. Didn't like the fact that I had overheads. Didn't like the fact that I had to staff them. Thought that, you know, the retail space, as you mentioned, is shrinking and everybody's going online. And soon, you know, no one's going to be buying supplements in retail stores, it's all going to be online. how this came about, we moved into what is now our current headquarters building. We'll be in until we move in April in 2011.
So this is Edwardstown?
This is Edwardstown.
Okay, pause. Yep. That's my dad's. My dad ran his first company out of that building.
Really?
It used to be called Signlight.
Oh, yeah.
Signage company.
Yeah.
What's the street again?
Oh, Woodlands Terrace.
Woodlands Terrace.
Yeah.
I have heard that it's been a bit of an epicenter of global businesses and brands.
Exactly, yeah.
No, there you go. So it's all in the building.
As a little kid, I used to kick around probably in your office.
Wow.
Anyway, please.
That's I didn't even know that. That's awesome. So we moved into our current, where we are now is our current headquarters. And the idea with that space was to have office, warehouse. When we moved in there, we had all this space for office. And I thought at the time, well, why don't we have like a showroom, have like a retail showroom where people who order their supplements in South Australia, who live close, can come and pick them up rather than having them sent out. That was the idea behind it. So we did it. So we had the space. We had, I think it's less than 50 square meters. So a small space, little retail showroom. Come in, pick your subs up. We started advertising it. And we started getting people come in wanting to buy supplements there, like then and there on the spot. We didn't have FPOS, anything. It was all cash only. But people started coming in and it became quite busy with people coming in and it effectively became a retail store. So we set it up as a retail store. We got some proper shelving and FPOS facilities and this sort of thing. And it kept growing and growing and growing. And I was like, wow, I don't understand. From my perspective, I was so like, bricks and mortar retail in this space is dead. What is going on? I couldn't understand it. So I started doing a little bit of research with supplement stores and what they were doing and why people were coming and shopping with us. And so I went and visited, some of our bricks and mortar competitors in Adelaide, and the stores looked horrible. They were run down. The customer service was bad. They never had products in stock that people wanted. We were effectively, without even knowing it, doing a much better job at bricks and mortar retail than the competition was doing, and that's why our business was growing. And so I thought, well, man, if we're doing this much business out of and where our headquarters building is down a side street off a main arterial road with no parking, it's completely non-convenient for people to come there. And I'm like, if we're doing this much in a non-convenient location down a side street in an industrial precinct, imagine what we could do if we actually do a proper retail store. So I decided, well, let's give it a shot. And so we built our flagship store, which is Massive Joe's Dernancourt, obviously still there today, and did a proper retail store. So in a shopping village, proper parking, really nice fit out, and has been incredibly successful.
And what year was this? Or when did you open?
That was 2013. Yeah, so three and a bit years ago.
What's been sequence then of so locations.
So then the sequence there. So we did Dernancourt, our flagship store, and that went exceptionally well. And then a year after, well, not quite a year, probably 9 months after that, we did another retail store, which is Gawler, which was our third retail store, and that was incredibly successful. So then 6 months after that, we did another retail store, that was very successful. Another one. Once we'd actually done Gawler, so we had three, we started looking at, okay, if we do more retail stores, where are we going to put them? So I did some research on what the good big retailers were doing and geographically where they placed themselves.
And did you link that to your traffic? Like, could you make an assumption based on where people or where were they buying you online? Where did they live? Or you just had to take a punt more on foot
just
traffic?
Just take a punt, yeah. Yeah, take a punt. Not necessarily on foot traffic, but on it still has to be convenient. People go to bricks and mortar retail because it is convenient. So then we put a plan in place to where, what does South Australia look like as a retail network as we continue to open these stores? So, and we put that plan together. And so then we did Flinders Park, Western Suburbs. We did Norwood, Eastern Suburbs. We did Seaford, Southern Suburbs. And we did Parabanks, Northern Suburbs. And so that was all done at the start of last year. So Parabanks opened in February last year. And that's pretty much from a South Australian perspective, we've reached saturation. So we can open 20 retail stores, but they're going to start stealing sales from each other. So at that point, we're going, okay, well, now we need to look at other states. So this is where we start looking at traffic. So we're like, okay, where are we sending most of our orders to? Where is there a big market? Look at the competition, who's not doing a good job, where is the opportunity, you know, similar sorts of things that we did for our South Australian retail stores. And so then we decided to do Perth. So we did Perth the middle of last year, June 2016, and then Melbourne we did in October, and now Sydney's the next one. That'll be probably April this year.
So why Perth is the next step out? Were you getting... Was it a big market for you guys online?
It was so
heap of bogans that loved it. I lived there for 10 years, so I can say that.
Perth was an interesting one for us. I mean, we send from an online perspective, we send a lot of orders to Perth. So straight away, it was the first interstate retail store was either going to be Perth or Melbourne. It was just which one do we do first? What happened in Perth was the big bricks and mortar. There were two big bricks and mortar retailers over there, and one of them bought the other. So there was effectively one big bricks and mortar retail. And so we saw that as an opportunity to go over and provide competition.
Whereabouts in Perth is it?
We're in Morley. Yeah. Yeah. So north of the river.
South of the river, boys.
Yeah. You're either north or south in Perth.
So at the moment, I'm just hearing a whole lot of success stories.
Sure.
Where have been the chinks? Where have been the moments that you may have doubted, if at all?
Mm-hmm.
The hard times, when do they occur?
Every day. Yeah. Pretty.
And you don't say that flippantly. Every day is hard.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
So what makes it hard?
There's one challenge or another popping up.
As in spot fires or you got to deal with, or is it you're unsure so you don't know what to do? What is it?
Yeah. It's pretty much a combination of both. I mean, you know, the spot fires pop up, I'm sure, in any business every day, if not every second day. You know, I actually had to cancel my interview with you guys last week because I had one pop up last week. That was probably a bit more than a little spot fire. It took a little bit more to get on top of. But, I mean, those sorts of things happen every day. In terms of, I guess, the kind of longer term, what do I do? Where do I go? Self-doubt sort of thing. I still get that a lot. I still get that a lot because I can't, from a business owner's perspective, I'm like, well, what if tomorrow people, for whatever reason, stop buying supplements? I mean, what am I going to do? I've got these bills to pay. I've got staff to pay. I've got, all of these responsibilities,
It's fantastic to share that because it's a point that so many people would look at you and just assume does not apply.
Yeah.
You know, multi-million dollar business, 30 people. So you now got retail stores, great brand.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting to hear that, you kind of have to work at it every day.
Mm-hmm. And with your background as well, I mean, you know that you've got fallbacks. You know, if it all went pear-shaped. Has there been times where you thought, you know what, like this is just too hard. You know, I could be in a cruisier gig with a simpler life.
On a oil rig in the North Pacific.
100%.
In Papua New Guinea.
100%. I mean, you can ask my fiance about this. I think I probably mentioned to her selling the business probably once a week, legitimately.
Any offers?
I'll take it another way.
Yeah.
What type of, private equity or competitor, who would you be attractive to, put it that way?
Who would we be attracted to?
Yeah, as a business to purchase. Who would be interested in you?
It's a very diplomatic way of translating my question.
Yeah,
I thought it's more manipulative.
Yeah, no, it's a very good question. I mean, the first thing would be one of our competitors straight away.
Yeah.
One of our competitors with some good financial backing and there are, I mean, the two that I mentioned to you are both very well financially backed, would be the most obvious option. Apart from that, I mean, I speak to guys in the industry about it all the time, about what the industry looks like in 5 years and 10 years and 15 years and 20 years. And you kind of look at specialty retail that we're a part of being eaten up by mass retail. So you start looking at, supermarkets, department stores, these monstrous retailers that are looking to get into a different space.
They'll do beer, they'll do pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, they'll do everything.
They'll sell everything.
Well, I mean, you look at Amazon in the US, they sell everything. Mm. It's like the ultimate retail store, and they do now bricks and mortar retail stores. It's not just online. So you start looking at your massive retailers like that. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing for the consumer, you know, is open to discussion.
I'm surprised a private equity hasn't knocked on your door and said, look, you've got a formula, you've got a brand, we'll inject shit ton of money and you cookie cutter it out and we'll do a deal and you'll exit and make lots of money. And
how do you know that they haven't already done that?
That was my subtle way.
We haven't already done that. I can tell you that straight up.
But I mean, you know, how much pleasure or stress or how much, I mean, clearly now you're not necessarily, you know, you're not out there posting something on Instagram because that's your job because you have to do social media. You're looking at the next things, the big things. Yep. How much pleasure or enjoyment do you actually take in the business challenge? What next?
Love it. Yeah.
So all these things you'd be thinking about constantly.
100%. Yeah. It never stops, literally. No, I mean, that's what, yeah, I mentioned to you guys that I'd probably tell my fiance once a week I'm going to sell the business because I'm so stressed about something. But that's what, you know, continually pulls me back is the challenge and, you know, the ability to just do good things, you know, to create really good things. And there's, you know, I still think there's a massive opportunity for us to do so much more. And that's what, you know, keeps me interested and motivated and working hard.
And it comes back to the community of Massive Joes as well, in that you have that real personal connection. Mm-hmm. Like you have an influence over people. You're not just pushing product.
Most definitely.
You can write something, you can pour your heart out after a big week and you'll get guys
validation
who'll be sharing the same pain.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah, absolutely.
Just coming back to that, I don't mean to dwell on it for too long, but who are the people, I mean, you mentioned your fiance, you know, everyone that we've spoken to seems to have one, two or three people that they can just be completely honest with. Is there anyone else in your life that you kind of give very transparent view to what's going on?
No, not really. No, it's pretty much just my fiance at the moment to be completely transparent. I mean, you know, I've got guys in the business who have been with me for, you know, 5+ years who I trust immensely. And, you know, we'll talk about business related things every now and again, but, you know, I'm not going to tell them that, you know, I'm stressed to my eyeballs and I'm thinking about selling the business because they're still employees, right? So, you know, you have to keep a positive outlook and, you know, you're the leader. So people look up to you. So you have to lead effectively. Yeah.
I guess as we begin to wind things up, one thing that fascinates me about the way you go about it is this complete focus that you have on this world of health, nutrition, bodybuilding. As an entrepreneur, that can be bloody hard because there's always a carrot. You always see an opportunity. And I'm sure that you, with the way your mind works, you'd see other opportunities in other businesses and temptations. How do you just stay focused and how have you seen the advantages of that?
I get asked this question a fair bit actually, especially by people who are interested in the entrepreneurial side, so to speak, because I don't consider myself an entrepreneur at all. And I'm really, if you compare me to other people who are, you know, entrepreneurs, I don't fit the mold because I don't have my finger in multiple pies. I don't
Selling Coke as cans of Coke as a retailer in year 10 probably.
At this point in time, it's literally like the one focus.
You're a business owner.
Yeah. And there's a quote that I refer to, and it was a Steve Jobs quote, and he said that the opportunities that you say no to are even more important than the opportunities that you say yes to. That's effectively what I live by because I do get a lot of different opportunities to do a lot of different things. But if I start saying yes to a lot of those opportunities that are outside of the realm of what I'm doing, I'm giving up opportunity costs that I could be spent focusing on what I'm supposed to be focusing on. So, you know, all of us have 24 hours in a day and you have to decide how you're going to spend those 24. And for me to do the best job that I can possibly do with this business, I need to be putting as much of that into this business as I can, which means I need to say no to a lot of things.
I was going to ask another question, but I can't help it now. Can you give us one or two opportunities that you may have said no to over your time?
Nah.
Good man. Okay, then that was not my last question then. This will be my last question before rapid fire.
Yeah.
Areas that you'd love the business to creep into, broadly speaking?
That's a loaded question. My kind of vision for the business, I guess, is I'd like to have, you know, bricks and mortar retail stores all over the country, and be, you know, the strongest player from that perspective, you know, in Australia, and then start to look internationally, because, you know, in Australia we've got such a small population, we're so isolated from the rest of the world, you know, and I think what we do as a business can be incredibly successful on a global scale, let alone on a national scale. But, you know, you have to start small. So you got to start somewhere. So,
good answer. You've had some media training or something.
He's polished. No, he's good.
So, I mean, that's kind of where I, you know, where I envisage the, in, you know, the next 5 years, kind of Massive Joe's heading.
Fantastic.
Would be there. Yeah. And, yeah, well, I mean, I can keep going if you guys want. I've got all sorts of plans. Well, but
I'm sure we're going to turn the mic off.
Yeah,
and our audience, and we'll just keep just going. Absolutely miss out. But yeah. Oh well, bad luck.
Yeah.
So we have this little section called Rapid Fire. It's a terrible section because we never prepare the rapid fire questions, and the rapid fire questions are generally long winded, like this one.
Mm-hmm.
But just before we actually get into it, you've brought in.
So hang on, this is rapid fire.
No, this is not rapid fire. This is pre rapid fire.
This is pre rapid fire.
Because nice.
Actually, that sounds like some sort of fueling supplement.
There could be a pre workout supplement.
A pre rapid fire.
Pre rapid fire.
Very good. Well, on that, you've brought in this little tub.
Yep.
Utopian, and you've said it's all about focus and concentration.
Yeah.
And this is like the next wave in supplements.
Absolutely. Yeah. One of the next waves.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I've seen, you actually asked this question earlier on and I didn't get around to answering it, but you said, how big was the market when I first started? One of the things I've seen, you know, keeping in mind that I've been doing this now for, this will be my 12th year. And I really got in right at the start of when the supplement side of things started to boom, so to speak. What I've seen is the market grow from, like, back when I was, you know, selling supplements at the university gym, the only people that were taking supplements were guys who were interested in bodybuilding. That's it. If you were a performance athlete playing AFL footy or basketball or whatever.
What are you coughing?
I was just talking about performance, high elite.
Performance athletes.
I'm coughing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, okay.
You weren't interested in it back then. You know, most of them still aren't interested in it now. But, you know, if you weren't in the bodybuilding world, you weren't interested in supplements. Now you fast forward to now and it's like, well, performance athletes are interested in it. People who aren't interested in bodybuilding, aren't interested in performance but care about the way they look are now interested in supplements. People who don't even care about the way they look but want their brains to perform better are now interested in supplements. People who don't care about the way they look, the way their brains perform, physically their performance, but just want to, you know, make their joints less sore are interested in supplements, or want to improve their lifespan possibly are interested in supplements. So the market has grown from this really small niche, it's still niche market, but to a much bigger niche. And so what I brought in for you guys today, the Utopia, is one of the next kind of waves that I see in supplementation, and that's looking at your mental performance, looking at your brain performance rather than your physical performance. So supplements that are designed to affect the way that your brain works, the way that your brain performs, and increase your psychological performance to help you do better at work, help you do better at studying if you're a student, you know, help you do better at anything where you need to concentrate and use your brain rather than your body.
So I'm so going to try this. So when do you take it?
Before you are going to do anything mentally demanding.
Okay.
10, 15 minutes before.
How often can you take it during a day without?
I'd say twice max. Yeah, I wouldn't be taking it more than twice.
Maybe we should spend 15 minutes in a couple of weeks and give a bit of a product
review.
Give it a shot.
We should. Yeah, absolutely.
I might try it.
Absolutely.
So rapid fire. Have you got the first one, mate, or am I kicking off?
No, you go.
First one for rapid fire from me.
Mm-hmm.
If you could only, yeah, I'm speaking slowly because I'm thinking. No. If you could choose one exercise only to do in the gym, what would you do?
One exercise only.
Yep. Your number one exercise. Oh.
Is that even a question?
Well, it is. the other thing.
This is like hell for me right now.
Yeah. The other thing is that you can't not have an answer.
Too many people say,
they're all, you know, important to me.
Blah. Yeah. Now, I think for anyone that's listening that follows me in the competitive bodybuilding world, I have to say it would have to be a chest exercise because everyone gives me shit all the time about having an underdeveloped chest. So I'd have to say let's go with incline dumbbell press.
Beautiful.
Okay. Good.
Two supplements you personally take.
I take a lot more than two supplements.
Yeah, I want two of your favorites.
Utopia. Yep. I'll say Utopia because I take that every day. Another supplement that I take, which one do I pick? Core Hard, which is a cortisol control supplement. Helps keep your cortisol levels down.
What was Arnie like to meet?
Amazing.
Why?
Yeah.
Why?
The first time I met Arnold, I've never been starstruck in my life, ever. First time I met Arnold Schwarzenegger, had no idea what to do with myself, like none at all. I was at the Arnold Expo in Melbourne, and Arnold comes around to, you know, meet and greet, who's going to meet and greet, and he's surrounded by this security, like this swarm of security, and then behind the security guard is this swarm of people. And so I see the swarm coming, and Arnold's coming to meet me, and I knew he was coming to meet me because they tell you what time to be ready and that. And this swarm of people, so you can't see Arnold, just see the swarm of people. And then Arnold pops out and I'm like, oh my God, it's Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Well, it sounds like a religious experience.
It was, 100%. And I've got it on film because we had a videographer there filming the whole weekend for us. And thank goodness that I do because I can't remember it at all the first time I met. Now I've met him, you know, 5, 6, 7 times. So it's different now. But the first time it was, incredible.
Wow.
Do you listen to music when you work out?
Yes.
Favorite current song and cheesiest song that comes on in your weights playlist?
Ooh, I don't have any cheesy songs because I specifically tailor my weights playlist so that I'm motivated the whole time.
What type of music?
I listen to hip hop.
Oh.
Yeah, when I train, I listen to hip hop. There's a few in there at the moment that are good. Bad and Bougie is probably one that's good at the moment.
The most viral social post
mm-hmm.
that you or Massive Joe's, the brand, has put up and why?
Ooh, I'm gonna have to think back for this one. The most viral social post.
Well, maybe the one that you remember. It doesn't necessarily have to be that really kicked off.
There's not one that stands out that I'm like, that's definitely the most viral post. And I think that there is a reason for that. I think because it's not a closed case like that. It's not like you do one viral post and that's kind of like what you hang your hat on and that's it. I think it's accumulation of, you know, a lot of different posts that get a lot of different traction for whatever different reason that kind of build this picture of the person or the brand and they work to complement each other. We have a viral post probably one every fortnight, I'd say, that goes viral, that gets a lot of people tagging, commenting, sharing, that sort of thing. And yeah, I think the cumulative effect of those posts is probably more than just saying this is one viral post that really nailed it for us.
Well, on that then, just as another quick one, I know this, we're going off rapid fire again, but what is it about these posts that perhaps resonate?
I think when you're able to touch people emotionally, I think is probably the biggest thing. You know, if you can get through those kind of superficial layers and hit something deep down inside somebody that touches them emotionally, that's when they'll start. You know, that firstly, that's what they'll remember, and then that's when they'll really engage with a social media piece of content as well. Yeah.
A reason that compelled you
mm-hmm.
to come on to Rooster Radio?
Or
off field?
I get asked to do this sort of thing, you know, podcasting and expos and that quite frequently. And most of the time, as I've mentioned to you guys, I say no because it's a pull of my focus away from the business. But I always research and did my research on you guys and saw who you'd interviewed in the past and listened to a couple of your podcasts and I was pretty impressed. And then one of the guys who works for me knows you very well, Monty. So I asked him about you, and he said, "Yeah, he's a good guy. He's a stand-up guy. you should do it." And I was like, "Okay, well, you know, if the research is good, and I know someone that knows one of the guys personally, then I got to do it."
So, another question: do you know everyone's name now that works for you?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, man, it's only 30 people.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Just a question. Don't shoot me down.
No, of course. Yep.
We should wind up, mate. Can you do the close? Because we're all sweating here. Yeah, just for context for the listener, it's about 42
degrees. Our air conditioner's not working. And there's not a bead of sweat on Jay, which I think kind of...
I'm acclimatized.
Also to paint a picture, you walk in and I mean, I don't care saying this, you're a specimen of a body. You're articulate. You're well presented. Joe, thank you for coming and spending your time with our podcast and giving us your experiences and a really open look as to how your business has grown, the things that, you know, you've noticed about what works and for sharing what is just a fantastic, I'll say it, entrepreneur story in a competitive world coming out of Adelaide. I just think it's like first class, mate, so I appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Appreciate that a lot.
Thanks for listening to our chat with Joe Mensel. Find out more about Massive Joes at massivejoes.com. Remember to subscribe to Rooster Radio if you haven't already and leave us a review if you like. Visit roosterradio.biz to sign up to our mailing list, and we're on Facebook at facebook.com/roosterradiohq.